You are listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes, and this is episode 24, and I'm so excited to have somebody that I really admire and look up to and have learned a lot from in the field, and especially in the EMDR field, which is Roger Solomon. And Roger is a psychologist and a psychotherapist with over 40 years experience in the mental health field. And he's specialized in police psychology, trauma, complex trauma, grief, and dissociation. And right now, Roger is the program director of the EMDR Institute. He's an author, he trains internationally in EMDR, and he's a consultant for the US Senate, for NASA, and he's provided clinical services and training to many different organizations, including the FBI, Secret Service, ATF, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Polizia di Stato in Italy. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And on the show, we dive into his career as a police psychologist, early days, and his experiences in providing critical incident debriefing and EMDR therapy. And he goes into a really helpful and useful overview of some of the theories that can help us in working with grief and trauma. And we really dive into the intersection of trauma and grief and ways to work with traumatic bereavement. There's so much wisdom on this show and some great tips. We talk about therapist pitfalls and some of the things that we can get wrong when we're working with trauma and grief. As always, if you like the show, give it a rating. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook, just under the Social Work Me podcast. And if you want to hear more from Roger on the topic of trauma and grief, I really recommend his training. It's a webinar on utilizing EMDR with traumatic bereavement, and I'll put a link in the show notes for that. This episode is brought to you by Rebel Office, and it would only be possible with the support of Southwest Counseling Services in Sarnia, Ontario. All right, let's get to the show with our amazing guest, Roger Solomon.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.
Hey Roger.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, just so you know, this podcast, I mean, there's a lot of newer clinicians, psychotherapists, social workers that listen to it. So you know, I wasn't thinking that we would dive right into the mechanics of EMDR or anything like that, but just, you know, talk about your experience with law enforcement, with trauma, with grief. But I'm actually, you know, maybe to start off, just really curious what's the last year looked like for you? I know you've been kind of all over the map and writing a book and doing a lot of things. So maybe, could we start there?
No, sure. So the world turned upside down March 15th. Of last year when all the live trainings got canceled. So for the last year, it's certainly been an adaptation like it has been for all of us. But here's where my past experience and work on resilience came in handy. I did a lot of workshops or webinars, mostly sharing, you know, pro bono webinars on resilience, and then started switching from live presentations to online, and then doing EMDR therapy sessions online. And if you would have told me, March 15th, 2000, or March 18th, or so, 14th, you know, 2020, I'd be doing EMDR online. And even doing tapping, I would have considered those fighting words. Okay. But certainly over this year, it's been a surprise on how well EMDR therapy works online, both with the taps, also with doing eye movements, Also, with the therapeutic relationship, you can regulate a person online. Again, it's very important you take extra steps that you know your client to do an assessment. But some of my most intense and probably most valuable sessions for the client have been online. I've been online. So I've really, really been amazed.
Wow, that's cool to hear. And I guess working on your book has been on the side. And then, you know, we've been trying to get together for a while. And I know you've been helping a lot in Washington, D.C. Can you?
Yes, I live in Arlington, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. In fact, let me just put this up a little bit higher. There we go. And I moved here maybe, going on 7 years ago now. I'm a consultant with the United States Senate. So there is an internal employee assistance program, and I provide, as we call it, EMDR for assessment and referral purposes. And certainly given recent events, of course, we've been very busy.
Yeah. And are you able to talk a bit about how you're helping with sort of the aftermath of the Capitol Hill and the riots and everything? Can we?
Not specifically. I think what I can say is a couple of things. You know, one, EMDR therapy is wonderful. And EMDR is very helpful with recent events. What also has been very helpful is a resilience-based debriefing, let's call it, or resilience-based one-on-one. So this is certainly something I've been involved with my whole career, and it's what I used to do with first responders prior to knowing EMDR, and that was to go through a critical incident frame by frame, moment by moment, and focusing on a moment of coping, a moment of strength, a moment of doing something for other people or oneself. Is every action, thought that takes place after the moments of, I call it, oh shit, vulnerability awareness, are moments of control and even moments of strength. So I did a lot of work with the resiliency debriefing, going through what happened and what people did to cope. And then following up after that, after that kind of stabilization, being able to follow that up with EMDR as a referral and assessment tool. Okay. Then the context where I work was, again, very helpful. So, of course, there's other things as going on as well. And there's a lot of other programs that were done in terms of education, getting support available, what people needed, individual and group, and the you know, again, the response, you know the response to provide support of people impacted was just superb. Huh. Really, really just superb. So
nice. Well, and if we can go back in time for a minute here, I, you know, read back through some of the things that you've accomplished in your career and read about some interesting findings that you had in the 70s working with law enforcement and kind of discovering that, you know, a lot of the officers didn't want to talk to a shrink.
That's right, because you have to have a problem to talk to a shrink. And who, you know, who has a problem? So this is where I started getting into peer support. And with a FBI agent that I met in Colorado, and this is 1979, Jim Horn, we started doing a lot of education on critical incident trauma and setting up peer support groups. So, you know, it's one thing for me, a psychologist, to say nightmares and flashbacks are normal. I can say that. I'm a psychologist. But it's something else for a fellow officer who's been through something similar to say that, you know, after my incident, I had nightmares, I had flashbacks, and I'm not nuts. And if you're going through this kind of experience, you're not nuts either. So who's going to have more credibility? So peer support is now very big, and also part of a project now in Virginia, where we're providing advanced training to officers who are part of a peer support team.
And it was really interesting to read about some of the psychological testing you did on applicants that wanted to be SWAT team members, wanted to be hostage negotiators, bomb squad members.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit about that? And
sure. Special team selection, which is part of what a police psychologist would do. There's the pre-employment screening. And then afterwards, there can be some special psychological assessment for special team selection as well, which involves an interview and some of the same psychological tests that we would use.
And maybe, I don't know if you can speak to like an overview or some of the qualities. What would make somebody a good special teams officer or law enforcement member?
Well, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, too. So, you know, certainly want to take a look at, you know, at the applicants or persons, you know, past behavior. So we're talking about being able to function under stress, think clearly under stress. And it's very important to be able to cooperate with other people. All right. Very important to be able to cooperate with fellow team members. Also, of course, to be able to, you know, to follow orders. So one of the, you know, an example, a test question that is routinely asked would be if there's a hostage situation and now there's a, let's say two people walking out, one person holding a gun on the other and they're walking out and you get the order, shoot the hostage, what would you do? And the correct answer is shoot the hostage, because it could be, okay, because it could really be the hostage taker. So, but this is also all part of training. But the goal of all psychological, you know, assessment and testing is to select somebody who's mature, you know, psychologically mature and psychologically healthy, and also has resilience as well, the ability to function under stress, the ability to bounce back after some kind of a critical incident. So there's not a lot of data on or selecting in a person on the basis of psychological testing data. You know, so, but there certainly is data on selecting out people. But when you combine psychological testing, an interview, looking at a person's background, so you can get a fairly good idea about a person. And for special squad selection, given that it's already officers who are experienced, there's already a lot of data that is known. So certainly there's going to be differences too. Let's take a look at values. So for example, a SWAT team, they are called to a situation when there's really life and death threat, and a successful SWAT operation is when they do not have to use their weapons. So we're talking values here. That the goal is to contain the situation, restore order, save lives. So certainly values. And when we're talking about hostage negotiators too, it's the same thing. It's saving lives. And it's the ability to, you know, connect with people and you know, negotiate, not just negotiate, but communicate. So this is something else, particularly in these times, values and responsibility and acceptance and dedication to the mission, because there is violence that is involved. There are people who kill other people, and there are people who kill police officers. So you want values and respecting, valuing human life. But at the same time, there's got to be the ability to respond and acceptance of the mission that sometimes there's going to be taking a life, which indeed can be a traumatic incident for the officer.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that. And I imagine in the last 40 years, the word trauma and maybe the definition or how often it's discussed has evolved. And I know that in reading a bit about your time as a police psychologist, that you began to see that even sort of vicarious trauma and not even being maybe directly involved with a scene could be traumatic for officers.
Yes. Yes. Responding to a scene and there's your buddy laying there, shot or wounded, or watching it or hearing about it, and you can't respond. So there can be a line of duty injury, a line of duty death, and the officer who's maybe on a day off can feel very guilty that there was nothing they could do, or, you know, maybe if I'd been there, I could have done something. Also, and it's now included in the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder, witnessing violence. Now, you know, for example, in these days of high tech and pornography, there are officers who have to watch hours of child pornography in detail. And this can be traumatizing. The same thing with district attorney, investigators, prosecutors. This can be traumatizing. The good news is that EMDR therapy can be very helpful with this kind of vicarious trauma. And I am glad that it is included in the definition. So police officers, firemen, social workers, child welfare workers see horrible things. We're all suckers for kids. That gets to us. And seeing human suffering, and especially responding to a scene and there's many people wounded or dead and there's not a lot you can do, mm-hmm. can be traumatizing to some.
So I guess through your work as a police psychologist, really seeing the importance of peer support, of critical incident debriefing, but then I guess at some point you discover EMDR therapy. What was that like, you know, discovering that in your career, and how did that sort of impact your career?
Well, big time. It impacted my career. I'm proudly the program director of the EMDR Institute now, with the passing of Francine. I first learned about EMDR in 1989 in the Journal of Traumatic Stress. The article came out. And I thought it was interesting, but it was, I was very skeptical. Yeah, right, do eye movements. Oh, Francine Shapiro, California, they probably do it in a hot tub. You know. Then in 1989, in October, they had the ISTSS, International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies. Their annual conference was in San Francisco, and I had attended, and this was 2 months following the earthquake that had been in San Francisco. The epicenter was Santa Cruz. And I heard Francine speak. I did go to her workshop. I was interested and I was impressed, with how she explained it. She again that there can be memories that get maladaptively stored in the brain that get triggered. And there's something about eye movements and maybe REM sleep that's something to unlock the brain's healing potential. That's how she was describing it at the time. And she showed a videotape of a veteran where some just amazing work handled. And after that conference, I went down to Santa Cruz. I had been invited by the mental health center to do debriefings for the mental health center staff that had been involved in providing care to the community. Well, one of the volunteer counselors there was this Vietnam vet that Francine had shown on tape. And we got to talking, and I asked him, does it really work? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, show me. And he said, all right, think of something disturbing. And so I brought up something that had been distressing. There was some tense moments in a debriefing, and I brought that up, and he just did a couple sets of eye movements, and after that, I really couldn't understand why this incident that it even bothered me in the first place. And then I realized something changed. And I signed up for the course and June of 1990 is I think it was the second class that Francine taught in the United States.
And
But what really sold me is I tried it, I think, right after the conference with a truck driver. This was a patient of a physician who I knew, who said, hey, you're coming on down here, see my patient. The truck driver was driving his truck, and this 11-year-old boy on a bike ran in front of the truck, got killed. And the truck driver hadn't been back to work in 3 months. So I sat down and did a double session. One session to talk about it, to do what I usually did, and he met criteria and did EMDR, and hallelujah. He's back to work, I think 3 days later. And then I went back to Washington. I was Washington State Patrol Department psychologist at the time, and started calling up some of the troopers who I treated for PTSD. I said, hey, come on in. Somebody I want to show you. And that worked. So, and then the rest is history. Francine needed trainers in 1993. So there were 13 of us that were trained by Francine to be trainers. And there's still three of us active.
That's awesome. What approaches were you using prior to EMDR?
Probably more of a cognitive behavioral approach at that time, really trying to understand when it comes to trauma. Well, the two components, how are you perceiving it? Okay, all right. How is that impacting you? And then a lot of psychosocial education and normalization, telling police officers that the slow motion they experienced during a critical incident was normal back in the, as they started out full time 79, and telling them that it was normal was a game changer for many. Oh, I thought I was going nuts. These kind of perceptual distortions were not understood at the time. Okay. So, but still going through it frame by frame, and then also being able to put together fear. How do people respond under conditions of fear? What is it that enables these police officers to respond when they're faced with life and death threats? So that became a subject I really studied and have written about it. And it sounds like you may be familiar with some of that. And I'm finding the same principles. They were very useful after the January 6th incident in Capitol Hill.
And then at some point you really dive into grief and loss and traumatic bereavement. What led you down that pathway in your career?
Well, in working with police officers, I got involved with Concerns of Police Survivors. This is a big support group for the families of police officers killed in the line of duty, something that I did for 30 years. And so started working with police officers' families, the mothers, the fathers, the children, the spouses, the brothers, the sisters, et cetera, and fellow officers. So it's just something I fell into. And I met Teresa Rando when I was living in the Boston area at the time. And we started putting things together at that time as well, and started writing about it. So working with families of war veterans, you know, with war veterans, also again with other people as well, but working with families of police officers.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Teresa Rando. And when I took your EMDR, utilizing EMDR with traumatic bereavement training, I loved how you really provided the frameworks for grief and understanding it. And Rando's 6 R's was one of those. Do you think you could talk about how those theories, and maybe there's other ones that have worked?
Yes, there's, well, you know, first of all, you know, Terry Rando has talked about, she calls them the R processes, the processes that are important for the assimilation and accommodation of the loss, to go through the mourning process. So if, you know, I can just pull up a brief PowerPoint. You'll give me a minute here.
Yeah.
Be happy to do that. Hold on and start my slideshow. Now, if I can share my screen, there we go. Here we go.
Perfect.
So I would like to explain that the R processes, this is not a stage theory like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, the 5 stages. So we're talking about the processes that are important for healthy accommodation. And people go through it in their own way. It's usually one of the processes segues into another, but it goes back and forth. So this is not a stage theory. So the first phase is recognize the loss. When there's a traumatic loss of a loved one, particularly if it's sudden, unexpected, and violent, there's shock. We're numb. We're shocked. We're not feeling anything. So that's like the avoidance phase. So during some period of time, a person has to be able to acknowledge the death, that it happened, the person died, and understand the death, which means that they're not coming back. So at some point, the emotional impact hits. It could be several days, several weeks, most likely several months. You know, certainly that 6 to 9 month period, that first anniversary. And a person has to react to the separation. They have to experience the pain and give some form of expression to the reactions. And there's not just the primary loss of the person, there's secondary losses. So let's say one spouse dies and now the family has to move to another house because half the income is gone. Or, you know, certainly we, you know, talked about law enforcement, talked about the military, the officer or soldier gets killed. And there's not only the loss of somebody you love, family member too, but there can also be the loss of a welcoming culture, the, you know, actively involved in the culture of the military or, you know, the first responder organization as well. So, you know, children, you know, you move, the children are going to a new school, et cetera. And also adapting to a new status. I'm not married anymore. Okay. So these are secondary losses, which are also important to identify and also have to be mourned. So third, we have to remember, we have to recollect, re-experience the deceased in the relationship. Memories come up, and this is very important in healing. Certainly when we do EMDR therapy, those of you who've treated somebody have probably noticed that after processing the trauma, positive heartfelt memories arise that form an adaptive inner representation. We can think of the loved one, feel them in our heart. And that's what enables us to go on. There's still that connection. So we also have to remember realistically, this there's a tendency to say that the person who died is a saint, but realistically speaking, yes, there's maybe ambivalence and there were conflicts. And especially when the person who died was also the source of one's negative self-beliefs, negative self-esteem, or was a perpetrator in their life at some level. These memories also have to be dealt with. So there's remembering realistically as well. Now, mourning requires letting go of the old world, the attachment to the old world and to the deceased. We have to let that go because the person is gone. They're dead. So they're no longer here. So we may be thinking it's another loss of the assumptive world. I will grow old with the person. We're going to retire. We have to let that go. That's not going to happen. So that's what it's relinquishing the old attachments. But the next one is readjusting and moving adaptively into the new world without forgetting the old. Now, these go together, especially when you're doing EMDR therapy. When you go to process the trauma of the loss and the realization that my world is gone, then as that processes, a person does start to say, well, I can't adapt, I can't cope, I can go on. So the two go together. What there is a transformation of the relationship with to the deceased from loving them in the presence when they were alive to loving them in absence. And we also have to adapt to the new world, but we don't forget about the old world. So we are revising our assumptive world, developing that new relationship with the deceased. There still is that continuing bond, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And of course, our identity shifts too. And then we can reinvest in the world, reinvest emotionally, that life can still be meaningful. So these are the R processes, but it does need to be augmented by some other theories. So this is a very useful framework, but we need to have other frameworks as well. So research has shown that the variance in how we adapt to a loss is determined by our attachment style. So if and get back here, so, you know, think about it, that we have child caregiver interactions on the basis of which there'll be a secure attachment or ambivalent or anxious attachment, avoidant, learning how to, you know, shut down and disorganized. So when a person dies, our attachment system gets activated. Somebody we love is not here more. And there can be the sense of danger. This is quite threatening. It's going to activate our attachment system. So that can tap into how we handled separation distress when we were young. So attachment style, we can understand as schema, but based on child caregiver interactions that are maladaptively stored. So when we have complicated mourning, complicated grief, it can be due to the trauma of the loss, but it also because it's triggering maladaptively stored attachment-related memories that have to be identified and also reprocessed as well. So we have, Randall's framework, which is, it talks about the processes for assimilation and accommodation. And then we also have to take into account person's history, the ARC processes doesn't talk about. It's something different, but we can bring in attachment theory. The other important framework is continuing bonds. Dennis Klass, who I've had the pleasure of meeting and talking to. So we don't relinquish the relationship or the bond, it transforms. So there's a lot of cultures, for example, Asian cultures, where there's, in one's home, there's like a mini sanctuary and honoring of the dead. A lot of very important rituals to remember, to keep the, loved one in one's heart. So on the basis of studying these kind of rituals, Dennis Klass said, we don't, it's not like Freud said, where we withdraw or decathect our love so that we have the energy to put it somewhere else. Okay, we don't give up the bond. It transforms. And certainly this is what we see in EMDR therapy. We have to process the trauma of the loss, which can be very intense. A person experiences raw, felt emotions. And then adaptive information is able to link in. And quite often that is the positive, heartfelt memories, meaningful memories. So when we think of the loved one, we have these heartfelt, meaningful memories. And that's what enables us to go on. And the loved one still remains an attachment figure on the inside. Okay, so I think of that as good grief. And just seeing this consistently when I was working, in the early years, started searching the literature, Fairbairn, the adaptive inner representation composed of memories that we can identify with. So we have continuing bonds. We have Teresa Randall's R processes, attachment theory, also dual process theory, dual process. So here we can look at grief as a balance between doing loss orientation, doing the grieving, feeling the pain, but also what's called restoration orientation. We have to deal with the reality of the loss. There has to be adjustments, adaptations. There are challenges that a person has to adapt to in real life. And healthy grieving is oscillating between the two. Being able to do the grief work, put it aside so one can attend to dealing with the challenges of the loss in everyday life. An example of this is a friend of mine. Her mother died. And she had been one of the caregivers, lived very close to her mother, good relationship. And my friend's also a university professor. And as she said, it's very difficult, to be home at night missing my mother. It was helpful during the day. I go to work and then I can focus, I was able, to focus on what I do professionally. And that provided a balance. But more than that, the other challenges that might be there. So once one spouse dies and there's children, and now the partner has to adapt to that, or now there's the challenges of how am I going to deal with childcare now? And how are we going to deal with, you know, the other reality tasks that, that a person has to adapt to? So there's the that restoration orientation and loss orientation. And there has to be a balance that goes back and forth, oscillates back and forth, too. So these are four frameworks that I find very helpful in working with somebody who has experienced a significant loss. And let's broaden the definition, certainly with COVID, there's been a lot of loss, not just death, but loss of personal freedom, movement, for many people, employment, the way we work has lost. So a lot of us have adapted to it and come out stronger. But still, we, you know, loss of a relationship, loss of, you know, there's these same principles could apply to many different kinds of losses. And of course, each type of loss has its specific problems. Death of someone we love is different than a divorce, though both there are a, you know, there is a significant, you know, significant loss and grieving process, mourning process a person has to go through.
So many good points there. And I, you know, the dual process theory, I think, really helps to normalize people's experience. And you talked about normalizing law enforcement of like, oh, I'm not crazy that, you know, during the day I can focus on work and not the grief that I'm experiencing. And I think the other piece from your training that really helped me talking to clients and the psychoeducation piece was there's some points that you had mentioned about how with trauma, there's loss. And with grief, especially acute grief, there's a traumatic response.
Yes, for with every loss, there's a trauma. With every trauma, there's a loss. That's true. And the two interfere with each other. As if there's been a traumatic loss, that someone you love has died under violent circumstances. We go to remember them, we go to grieve, but the violent circumstances intrude and interfere with that. And then we go to deal with the trauma, the violence that happened, deal with the trauma of it, but then the loss of someone we love interferes with that. So they're both there and both have to be dealt with. So typically, where we would start would be, if I can use the expression, what's in your face? What's right there? And typically, that's the trauma of the loss, like getting the news, the moment of shock, or the moment of realization when you go, oh my God, now I'm realizing what happened. There may not be the full emotional impact later, but you're going, whoa, that realization that someone I love is died and you just told me. So at the appropriate time when the person meets readiness criteria, we can deal with the trauma of the loss. And that can be, you know, very intense. There's also, of course, the separation distress. After dealing with the trauma, the person's going through life. There's reminders, there's present triggers. There's the yearning. The person's gone. I still don't believe it. I went to pick up the phone and oh, they're dead and I really got triggered. These also, present triggers also have to be reprocessed along with future templates for each trigger as well. So the trauma of the loss, and sometimes that may be all a person needs along with present triggers and future. But if it's complicated grief or processing is blocked, then we can be guided by attachment theory. Are there previous losses, previous trauma, or attachment-related memories having to do with I'm not safe or I'm powerless or the person is gone and I can't survive, I can't have a life? Where is this coming from?
Okay. Yeah, and I guess as therapists, we can get pulled in all kinds of different directions and not always knowing where we should be going. And I like that kind of analogy of what's right here. what's in your face. But what do you think are some common therapist pitfalls when it comes to treating complicated grief or traumatic bereavement?
So it would be the same pitfalls that would be there with any complicated, trauma. And probably, the last 15 years, I've been very seriously studying and collaborating with colleagues on complex trauma dissociation and EMDR therapy. That one, does the person have the capacity to stay present? Okay, so I like to talk about the story of page one. So page one. So I do work with the railroad, also peer support training, but it's similar to the work that I do with first responders, with war veterans, and with therapists, 3 to 4 day workshop, tell your story, psychosocial education, and on a volunteer basis, one-on-one EMDR therapy. So there was a woman who worked passenger service and the train derailed and she was thrown all about. And afterwards, she could not get back on a train. Well, she saw an EMDR therapist who just dived right in, started doing EMDR therapy on the derailment. And it was very upsetting for her. As she described it, I was crying and there was no progress. So the therapist started doing exposure therapy, gradually having her approach the train station and approach the train. And as the client put it, it was working. I was getting closer, but it was brutal. Well, I met her at the workshop and we sat down and I asked her, have you ever had any other losses or trauma in your life? And she said at the age of 8, her brother died of cancer, but it started at 6 years old when he got diagnosed. And of course, all the attention went to him. People would come over and say, hello, how are you? Where's your brother? All right, then the brother died and the family never talked about it. All right. So she had been in therapy already for 10 months. She met the readiness criteria. So went and processed the loss of her brother and some attachment related memories as well. Then we processed the train accident. Then we did a future template. And she ended up riding on the train with me. I was in Canada, by the way. Okay. Perfect. And she's been riding ever since. Well, I asked her, did you tell your therapist about this, about your brother? And she said, no. And why not? He didn't ask. Well, I'm telling this to my co-leader, Tim, who's a retired locomotive engineer. And as well as he was an executive. He was the ombudsman for Union Pacific Railroad. And I'm telling him, our therapist never asked about our history. And Tim goes, hey, isn't that on page one for you guys? What's on page one? Okay. What's on page one? So besides taking a history, you can do we call it now a safe space exercise, safe place, safe space. You can do resourcing and you can get an idea how the person processes, how they do and get an idea of their capacity. Does the resource enhance? Are there negative associations or there's no emotions or they shut down as well? So the other thing I think can be very difficult, not just with grief, but it can be very emotionally intense. The realization that the loved one is dead and not coming back can indeed be traumatic. It can be very intense, too. So I think therapists need to be prepared for that. And it really takes the ability to be present with that. So EMDR therapy is important. Matter of fact, I've always known the therapeutic relationship's important. All right, that's here. But EMDR, hey, we got EMDR. I've changed up for complex trauma or complicated grief, okay? The other way. EMDR certainly is important. But again, that therapeutic relationship to hold the person, that there is the trust that's there. And the John Watkins would put it, therapist ego, client's ego combining. Okay, it makes the client bigger than the problem, or it's the window of tolerance of both combining. This helps the client get through that. But certainly the relationship, we need to be present with the client, because if they go to hell, we're right there with them going through to the other side. So that can also be a pitfall. Another pitfall, a very experienced grief therapist, very experienced, and was doing EMDR therapy, said, "My God, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. My God, all this emotion comes up, they work through it, but so much comes up, it doesn't stop. How do you get it to stop?" Well, as I talk with the person more, what are you doing? They were just going right in on the emotion. Start with the specific memory. Because when you start going, when you go into something traumatic, there can be a lot of emotions coming up. And going back to the memory you started with, going back to target provides structure and containment as
Nice.
well.
Well, and when I think back to some of my own pitfalls, early days of using EMDR therapy, I think, and maybe a lot of people deal with this too, is sort of wanting to stay to the 20 to 30 second set, or being, for me at least, maybe overly sensitive or cautious to ab reactions. And it was really honestly watching your tapes in that EMDR training with you that kind of gave me the confidence, watching you do longer sets, watching you encourage them. I know this hurts, but just notice it, and continuing on with the bilateral stimulation, that sort of gave me that confidence to stay in the emotion, to be able to deviate into sitting in that a little bit longer with the client.
Yes, that's important. And I think we have to be careful in the basic training that no matter what we do, what we say, that people can think about it as a rigid protocol. And we give you a manual and we have facilitators who insist, read it. Okay. But this is because there's so many steps. Don't want that you're not going to have it memorized. We'll take you through it. And then, of course, once you start to practice, it really is a dance. And as Francine always said, that EMDR is not a recipe. It's not a cookie cutter. You adapt it to the client. So indeed, if there's intense emotion, you'll be doing longer sets. Get the client up over the hump and down over the other side. But for some clients, they will do better with shorter sets. And we're looking at the face, we're looking at the breathing. I think of it as the art of EMDR, which is another workshop I like to do, the relational aspects of EMDR therapy. So it's very much focused on the client and what we're doing. Well, we do a set. We say, take a breath, let it go. What do you notice? And the client says something. That tells us what to do next. Do we say go with that because it's changing and shifting? And if they're blocked, there's a number of different things we can do. So we're tracking our client, and what we do depends on the response we get from the client. So it's really very interactive. But we do have to start somewhere with this. And so here's your manual. I think of it as your new best friend. You take it with you into session. And then after a while, it integrates. And then you're able to go through, say, the assessment phase as a conversation, because it's just good therapy. The assessment phase, you get an image. Well, okay, what's the worst moment? That's right there. It's easy to get. But the negative cognition, not so easy, because it's the meaning of the event to the self. It's the verbalization of the affect that's there that can be hard to put into words. The meaning to the self. In terms of, we have four categories now for negative cognition: responsibility, safety, control. Now we've had have connection and belonging. Added that one, two, and then the positive cognition. It's a therapeutic goal, and of course VOC. And then we're going to go in the body. We'll get emotions, the suds, which requires you to go deeper, and then finally the sensation. Where do you feel it? That's the purest form of the dysfunction. So going through these components is just good therapy, from the image to the meaning to the self to the therapeutic goal, then into the body, and then we go. So once it's a can take a while to get the flow, but it's just good therapy.
I love how you break that down. It does sound like an art. And we're sort of running out of time here, and I wanted to get to one question that I really like to ask everybody, especially people that have had a 40 plus year career like yourself. You see so much trauma and loss and pain. What do you do to manage or prevent or mitigate vicarious trauma and burnout?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think with EMDR therapy, there's not as many therapists are burning out because our clients get better. But if I had to put it, because I'm thinking about it, many people ask about it. So a couple things. One, does come with experience. When I first started out in this work, especially working with the families of police officers, and they'd gather for 3 days, Washington, D.C., May 14, 15, and 16, and you'd have hundreds of people. There's like this wall of grief. It's, oh my God, it just hits you. And my children were small at the time, and I'd call them up, hey, you okay? And they go, oh, Dad must be doing another one of those trauma seminars or grief seminars. All right. So, there certainly is an adaptation period, but what does help is the realizing that, well, I think we have to say, at least it was for me, that these kind of reactions and emotions are normal, and it's all right that our clients have that. So I first learned this when I was a graduate student at University of Chicago. I was getting my master's, and I worked with cerebral palsy adults. And I was very uncomfortable because they're in wheelchairs and some very stiff postures. And I'm going, I feel so sorry for them. Really saw it. But then after a while, I thought about it. I go, well, you know what? It's just what they have, it's the way it is. And as soon as I can accept that, then I could really see the person, not the affliction. The same thing with grief. Really, again, after getting through that wall of grief, which just blew me away, so much pain, then really started to be able to see the person through the loss and relate to the person. And then the same thing that I can accept that you have this pain. And then the other thing is, and I'm going to be part of your team to help you through it. And we get results, and that's anti-burnout medicine. We get the results, and I think all of us just share in the joy and the positive meaning that we get and seeing the transformation. So I'm just thinking of some clients that I just got some emails from, and including one who's a loss due to COVID, or just the image of the loved one coughing blood and not recognizing it was COVID, before. You know, too, that image was just traumatizing the person and be getting worse. And, you know, we've had a couple sessions more to do, but it's lessening in intensity. You see the person start to improve, start to really come back to life. So where it's evolved to is, all right, right now you're in pain. Okay, so we're going to sit down, and when we're ready, we're going to work through this, and we're going to come out the other end in a positive way. The thing I'll add, though, is give appropriate time, all right? There's, I think, another thing where people get frustrated, and, you know, too, is how come it's taking so long? Well, I work with a lot of complex trauma dissociation with people who were sexually abused when they were very young, along with neglect. So there's the disorganized attachment, plus the later abuse that gives rise to dissociative disorders. And there's some people that I've been seeing for years. And again, that's all right. People go at their pace, they get better, they go at their pace. And I think as therapists, we have to accept the person's pace and what is happening. And same thing with complicated grief, where there's also earlier trauma. We go at the person's pace. We stay with them, and we create that no shame zone, not only for their symptoms, you know, which we're able to explain in a non-judgmental way, but we give them the time that's needed as well, too. So,
and I guess that takes a bit of pressure off us too, the way that you sort of put that. This takes time.
Yeah. Yes, 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 it is. And to those therapists who are out there, if anyone's listening, that's some of you may have clients who seemingly just are not getting better. And you've been seeing them for years and they're not getting better. And these are probably people with very deep attachment trauma. The wiring maybe not didn't get put in there. And maybe the one thing they have looked forward to during the week is a meeting with you. So you're, even if you don't think they're getting better, you're still providing a very valuable and important service. Keep that up. You know, keep that up. That's right. It takes the pressure off you. Okay. It's not up to us. Okay.
That's a great public service announcement from Roger Solomon here.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Well, and it's been so great talking to you, Roger. And how can people get connected with you? And I'm sure you have trainings that you're offering and webinars. What's the best way for...
Well, right now, I'll just put on chat. It's okay. It's certainly okay to share my email, all right? And you know, put that on out. Most of the trainings that I'm doing now, because I'm still do training all over the world, but now doing more with the EMDR Institute, emdr.com. So if you went to the website now, you would see that it's going to be the last weekend, or April 30th, May 1st, Ono Vanderhart and I are doing a workshop together on EMDR therapy with traumatic attachment to the perpetrator. Okay, too. Nice. And then in September, I believe I have scheduled a workshop on grief and mourning. Okay. And then in December, still working on this, not up there yet, Dolores Mosqueda, and I will do something on working with intense emotions. And again, a lot of this will be, you know, videos, not just lecture, videos.
Great.
The other thing I would like to say, if anybody's seeing this, that I like to teach by demonstration, teach by videos. You cannot learn to drive a car or learn EMDR by lecture or looking at a book. You need seat time. Your hands got to be on the wheel. So I'm always looking for volunteers. Okay, clinicians know what EMDR is or know what they're getting into, who would be willing to volunteer or to do a demonstration that can be utilized for training, that, you know, for loss, for grief as well. This is my favorite seminars are when we can either do demonstrations or show videos and really go over these clinical fine points and really understand what the process is. And if anybody can can help with this process, I would sure appreciate that.
And they would just reach out to you through email to do that?
Yes. It's again, Roger M. Solomon at AOL.com. All right.
Perfect. No. Well, and I can't say enough again about the webinar that you can buy at any time and watch at your own pace, utilization of EMDR with traumatic bereavement. And the videos that you showed in that were fantastic. And we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but your mediators of mourning, so that the assessment breakdown was just fantastic. So I'll put a link up in the show notes for that training for anybody that's interested, because it was just been, it's been seminal in my work. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great to talk to you.
Well, happy to do that. And as I said before, that again, I would be happy to be a guest at the study group. It's very, I enjoy meeting my EMDR colleagues as well. We're a great community. Yeah. All right. You know, when you think about it, we really are truly a great community of therapists. And I think especially with EMDR therapists too, are really just in enthused about what we do as well. So if we can chat later and see if we can
line that up.
Scheduled coordinators. Yes.
That would be awesome.
All right. And to anybody watching this, again, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time, and Matt will be in touch.